This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we're taking a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, the countdown is underway as Solomon Islands gears up for next month's national elections. Fiji defends its decision to stick to a policing deal with China, and relief all around as the United States comes good on its promise of more funding for Micronesian countries. We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, the people of Solomon Islands head to the polls on April 17 to vote in an election viewed by many as the most important in the country's history. After 5 years of rapid change, including a controversial switch in diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China, incumbent Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare has been touring the country drumming up support for his future vision. But as Chris and Rita Amanu-Leong reports from Honiara, Mr. Sogavare's challengers have a very different view of the direction the nation should be heading in.
United! United! United!
If Peter Kenny Laurier Jr. gets his way, it's what Solomon Islanders will be in the mood for in next month's national election. In opposition since 2019, Kenny Laurier Jr. wants the top job. And watching on at his party's campaign launch in Solomon Islands' capital, Honiara, were what's viewed as his secret weapon. Young people.
He's real. He's got integrity. He's not a liar.
He thinks about the issues that affect us. School fees and looking after young people.
The son of the nation's first Prime Minister, many see Kenny Laurier Jr. as the only real rival to Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare. And in a country where 70% of the population is under 35 years old, Kenny Laurier's campaign is focusing on health, education and youth issues.
The party does not believe that our development partners will be the saviour of Solomon Islands.
Standing in his way is the incumbent Manasseh Sogavare.
We register this country now on map because of powerful decisions, important decisions that you're making. We become relevant.
Manasseh Sogavare is in his fourth stint as Prime Minister and he wants a fifth. His latest term has been dominated by one decision, switching allegiance from Taiwan to China. It triggered a wave of events, most notably riots in Honiara in 2021 and the signing of a secretive security deal with China. In a campaign speech late last week, Mr. Sogavare praised the Chinese Communist Party's governing style and questioned the merits of democracy.
Which for the last 45 years...
For the past 45 years, we have been struggling to make headway in development under the present arrangement. Even the opposition leader admits China is here to stay.
No previous Solomon Islands Prime Minister has gone to an election and re-emerged as the leader. Yet, most political watchers expect Sogavare to make history and win the April 17th elections.
If he is back in power, it's only because he has a following that he commands and that puts him up there.
Solomon Islands academic Dr. David Gegeo believes the Sogavare's storied history as a deft political operator puts him in the box seat. He says this was shown last year when Sogavare rode a wave of national pride after the country hosted the 2023 Pacific Games, its centerpiece being a $120 million new national stadium funded by China. But it's a country with high rates of poverty and a health system on its knees, prompting questions about the Prime Minister's priorities.
But I'm sort of a humanitarian. I mean, I'd rather see that our human daily needs, basic needs are met.
Peter Kenny Laurier Jr. offers an alternative path for the country, one he hopes voters choose.
The burden of developing Solomon Islands rests squarely on the shoulders of the government and people of Solomon Islands themselves.
The ABC has made repeated requests to interview Prime Minister Sogavare.
That report from the ABC's reporter in Solomon Islands, Chris and Rita Amanu-Leong. The government of Fiji has confirmed its intention to stick with the controversial policing agreement signed with China back in 2011 under the Bainimarama military regime. The original deal allowed for intelligence sharing and joint police training. But Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka ordered a review when his government took office after the 2022 election. Home Affairs Minister Pio Tikonduandua says with the final review complete, there'll be no major changes, but there is a provision for the agreement to be revisited twice a year. He spoke to the ABC's Agnes Tupo.
I don't think there is ever any perfect understanding, but it's something that we all work at continually. Obviously, it's based on mutual respect and also recognition of each other's integrity as a state. We have agreed that we will now send some of our senior police officers to study in China and also to look at certain areas where we can build a specialized capability for our police. So I can assure you that we have asked the Chinese if they can help us out with some of those mobile scare ones that will help our police to monitor, you know, law and order within our remote communities. I think it's relevant to any of the other provisions, security arrangements that we have with Australia and New Zealand. One area that we were concerned with at the beginning and which was the subject of our review is in the areas of intelligence sharing. We would like to review that in terms of what we necessarily have to share. I cannot go into the detail, but that is an important area.
Even with a review, though, has the government made any other changes to the agreement?
No, we have not, except that we have put in certain provisions that will allow us to look at this MOU every so often.
The Prime Minister himself, Sitiveni Rambuka, is yet to comment publicly on this agreement. So has he actually endorsed this deal?
We have spoken before I came. That is the agreement that we have reached as well previously, well before I went to China. We will continue with the MOU. We will continue to review it as we go along. And I'm glad the Prime Minister has endorsed it. And I believe he has also communicated that to his own counterpart within China. I had communicated our decision to continue with the agreement to the state councillor from China when I met with him, or perhaps the minister responsible for public security in Beijing.
Were traditional partners consulted as part of this review, or is this purely just an internal thing for Fiji?
Oh, this is Fiji's integral issue. But at the same time, we have a very, very comprehensive agreements with Australia, New Zealand, the United States in terms of law and order. You know, we have no enemies. We work with everyone for our betterment. We respect each other's sovereignty and integrity, and that is the basis on how we deal with each other. You know, Fiji will not be pushed over. We are not an agent for any particular power. We work with everyone, particularly for whatever is, you know, that will benefit, particularly Fiji and, you know, in the region as well in maintaining peace. And we want to continue to do that with all of our partners.
Agreements like this, do you ever think that it may cause a little bit of unease in Canberra, Washington and Wellington?
You know, we are a democratic nation. We aspire to democratic principles. At the same time, there are things to learn with everyone else. We are not selling ourselves short to anybody. We work at the way and how we keep Fiji, the region, and the world free of trouble. In Fiji, we have this big problem, you know, with drugs in particular. We need every assistance that we can get to help Fiji and our community. And if we need to go to China to clean Fiji of this problem, then we will do it. But we do it with people and nations who respect us as an equal partner. That's the guiding principle of our relationship with everyone else. And I want to assure our Fijian people that government does this in the interest not only of Fiji, but also in the interest of the region.
Fiji's Home Affairs Minister, Pio Tikonduandua, and he was speaking there with the ABC's Agnes Tupo. Palau's President Sorangul Whips Jr. says the approval of new funding agreement with the United States came in just the nick of time, allowing his country to avoid piling on more debt to keep public services running. Earlier this month, after a long delay, the U.S. Congress finally passed legislation enabling what's known as Compact of Free Association with Palau, Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia. Liam Fox with this report.
Last Friday was a day of celebration in Palau, according to Sorangul Whips Jr.
Because, I mean, this agreement has been, we've been waiting for it, anticipating it. And I would say just in time, because, you know, we've been talking about how important it is to get the funding so that we don't have to take out more loans and take care of those critical services and healthcare, education, and security.
He says Friday was when his administration exchanged notes with the US ambassador to Palau, effectively implementing the latest compact of free association between the two countries.
A win for Palau, a win for the United States. And really, at the end of the day, it's a stronger partnership for peace and prosperity.
The compacts between the US and the three countries of Palau, Federated States of Micronesia, and Marshall Islands have been in place since the 1980s. Under them, America provides funding for critical services, as well as visa-free access to the US and employment rights. In return, its military gets exclusive access to vast swathes of the North Pacific Ocean and unilateral use of military facilities like the Ballistic Missile Defense Test Site on Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshalls. But the latest iteration of the compacts, worth more than $7 billion US dollars in total, was held up for months after negotiations were completed because a bitterly divided US Congress was unable to pass the enabling legislation. Mr. Whip says things were looking grim.
We were hit hard with COVID. We're much deeper into debt than we were. The interest cost has gone way up, causing a big strain on our budget. So the financing to help pay down the debt and then allowing us some budgetary support so that we don't pile on more debt is really critical.
In a media briefing this week, U.S. State Department Special Advisor Taylor Ruggles said officials working on the agreements were also frustrated by the delay.
To our friends in the freely associated states, we acknowledge that the past few months have been uncertain at times. We've heard your concerns about the need to get COFA-related agreements done, and frankly, we shared them. Getting COFA-related agreements across the finish line was a top priority for the administration.
The obstruction in Congress occurred against the backdrop of increased geostrategic competition in the region between the US and its allies and China. Mr. Ruggles was asked if the delay played into China's hands.
We believe that the economic package in these agreements is going to play a vital role in building and maintaining a brighter future for the people of the region. I'll just say that our vision for a free and open Indo-Pacific does not exclude any country, but we'll continue to build on this already strong relationship.
U.S. State Department Senior Advisor Taylor Ruggles ending that report from Liam Fox. A new generation of Pacific diplomats are being trained on how to operate in an increasingly difficult geopolitical environment. As Carl Evans reports, the program is sponsored by the New Zealand Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and its participants could eventually have a big part to play in the maintenance of stability in the region.
The most significant agreement between Australia and a Pacific Island nation ever.
Handshakes, ribbon cutting, cheesy photos, that's what we the public see when countries strike a diplomatic agreement. What we don't see is the work that went on behind the scenes, work done by diplomats. Meetings and conversations that serve as the bridge between nations.
We can all see that the world is getting somewhat more disrupted and uncertain. Even in the digital age, actual live diplomacy based on people-to-people relationships and relationships of trust is more and more important.
Rosemary Banks is New Zealand's former Deputy High Commissioner to the Solomon Islands and Australia. She's heading up a new diplomatic training program for young Pacific diplomats from Papua New Guinea, Fiji and Vanuatu, who will go on to serve in their country's foreign service. More than 30 participants took part in the five-week program, which wrapped up this month. Another is scheduled for April and will feature participants from a wider area.
We'll talk about the skills that you need or the way that you should approach when you have to brief your minister or you have to brief your secretary of foreign affairs. How to deal with a difficult meeting with a representative from another country, how to conduct yourself and behave at an official function like a reception, which people think are, you know, for enjoying yourself and having a nibble and a nice glass of wine, but of course they're actually for getting your work done and finding the right people and expanding your network of contacts. So all of these tradecraft skills, if we might call them that, they will have initial training on.
So what kinds of skills do they teach? Well, they're quite vast, particularly in the digital age. But ultimately, they boil down to one thing, forging good relationships, which can be easier said than done.
We might ask them to split into pairs, for example, and one person is pretending to be a diplomat from another country and, you know, the other person is the home country diplomat, and they'll have a difficult issue that they're expected to discuss and work out between them. Or, for example, a lot of people find it quite difficult to work out how to circulate in a big reception, how to get the most out of it, how to meet people, how to interrupt somebody else's conversation. So we will have a networking reception, which is set up precisely as an opportunity for the participants to practice introducing themselves to people they don't know, initiating conversation, finding out points of common interest or work interests that they can connect with.
Elias Geramo is one of the participants. He hopes to use his newfound skills to generate more investment into PNG and create jobs for young people.
We need the necessary infrastructures, facilities, so we can, you know, convert those resources into monetary value to them. Economic diplomacy. I'm interested in economic diplomacy as to how I converse or dialogue with partners to bring them investors into the country. That's my interest and passion.
Elias says good diplomacy is the best way to find a solution to the issues that threaten the Pacific, the biggest of which is climate change. But experts say other threats are closing in. Deputy Director of Strategic Engagement at the Pacific Security College, Dr. Henry Ivarachure, says the next generation of Pacific diplomats will face a tougher job than any who came before them.
I don't want to be a diplomat now. It won't be easy. It will get very complicated, and there are too many complexities to manage. There will be too many actors in region, and the numbers will be increasing. So their relationship and their ability to manage those relationships will become really complicated. And, you know, they have traditional partners that they have to care about and maintain those relationships. And then they have to deal with additional players. And so I see, you know, in the future, new agreements coming into place, new security agreements coming into place.
Dr. Ivarachure expects geopolitical pressure from China and the US to increase in the coming years. Meanwhile, law and order issues in PNG, as well as cybersecurity, and an unresolved push for independence in Bougainville, West Papua, and New Caledonia could create instability as well.
When we have this politics of China trying to influence Pacific Island countries to switch diplomatic relations with Taiwan, and the possibility of investing in corrupt practices to try and persuade our countries to switch allegiance, so that could potentially have an impact on their foreign policy behavior.
But there's a silver lining. With everyone seemingly wanting a piece of the Pacific, Dr. Ivarachure says the interest will give diplomats leverage to get the best outcomes for their country.
One thing that we've got to remember is this geopolitics has given agency to Pacific Island countries. And they have to be able to exercise their agency sensitively and ensure that they actually benefit from the agency. The Pacific, everybody now wants to get into the Pacific, and they have to learn how to work those relationships, maintain their traditional relationships, work with the new parties that are coming in, and really look at all the bilateral agreements that they have and see how they can benefit.
Dr. Henry Ivarachure from the Australian National University's Pacific Security College, ending that report from Kyle Evans. A lasting solution to Papua New Guinea's ongoing fuel crisis is still a work in progress. And while the government continues to search for answers, as Belinda Cora reports, for the people of Port Moresby, there's uncertainty about where their next tank of petrol will come from.
On any given day, a trip to the fuel station remains unpredictable. Many residents queue up for a long time just to try and get petrol or diesel. While the government continues to assure Papua New Guineans it is doing something about the continued fuel crisis in PNG, some citizens are still not convinced. Frida Terelulu owns an Uber business in Port Moresby, transporting mainly women to and from work each day. She says on top of the rising cost of living, Papua New Guinea's fuel shortage is another headache.
Every day, We have to dig deeper into our pockets to, you know, refuel. 50 kina at 11 liters, that's not enough for a day. And with this Puma outlets closure, we have to stand in really long lines at Mobil to get fuel.
Papua New Guinea has been in the grips of a crippling fuel shortage for the past month, with the main supplier Puma Energy firstly not operating and now operating at a reduced capacity. It follows similar shortages in the last 2 years, and stocks have been rationed in recent months. Some supply has started to trickle through again, but business owners like Frida Tarululu are still worried.
They have to come out with what the real problem is and what the real issue is. They have to at least source fuel. If they say that they're going to source fuel from outside, they have to get that in as soon as possible. What's the hold up here?
The issue itself stems from the long-running dispute between Puma Energy and PNG's Central Bank, Bank of Papua New Guinea, over its foreign exchange orders. Last year, Bank South Pacific announced it was closing Puma Energy's accounts, with the fuel supplier now also using the much smaller PNG bank, Kina Bank. Prime Minister James Marape's cabinet has the Essential Services Act to allow the government to requisition major assets to show up supply. It's also directed the Central Bank and BSP to continue financial services to Puma Energy. For Shadow Minister for Petroleum, Energy and International Trade and Investment, Karenga Kua, it's not the solution.
But in that process, it's going to destroy Bank of Papua New Guinea, and it's going to destroy BSP Bank. And because Kina Bank is wanting to become entangled, even Kina will be destroyed. So we need to make it clear to Puma that it needs to organize an orderly exit, sell the business, get as much money as it can from the sale and leave, and then the operations will be continued by any third party who have the appetite to continue under the existing climate.
Mr. Kua believes there's another way, and continuing with Puma is not it.
The other solution is that when I was in cabinet, we had already approved a plan for MRDC in partnership with ExxonMobil to build an alternative import infrastructure system in Port Moresby. Land was already made available at Kanudi to MRDC, which was formerly owned by PNG Power. And MRDC and Exxon are already in the process of building that alternative supply system.
In his last press conference speaking on the issue, Prime Minister James Marape said there's a need to end the near monopoly that Puma Energy has on fuel suppliers in the country. He appointed his deputy John Rosso to oversee the introduction of further competition. As it stands, Puma Energy is the monopoly supplier of aviation fuel.
I want to also indicate that in the medium term, through this, we will enact laws. When we come back to Parliament in May, we'll pass certain laws that will reduce the monopoly of fuel supply and will open up the market. And this cabinet also has allowed for Kumul Petroleum Holdings Limited to be our national energy company that will work with subsidiaries in our country for the importation of fuel and for redistributions of fuel in our country.
But the uncertainty over fuel supply has been dragging on for months. Those hit hard in the National Capital District during these shortages include business owners who say they've had to dig deeper into their pockets just to make ends meet each day. Mr. Rululu, who also has children who go to school, says she wants the government to be clearer about what their permanent solution is to put her mind and others at ease.
It's really frustrating, you know, as a small business owner, we have to, and also not for me only, but other citizens as well.
Small business owner Frida Tarululu, ending that report from Belinda Cora in Port Moresby. And that's it from Pacific Review for this week. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the region. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.